From the traditional territories of the Lekwungen and Wasanik peoples on southern Vancouver Island, I'm Dean Murdoch, and this is Amazing Places. Welcome to another episode of Amazing Places. Today we're going to talk about zoning, land use, zoning regulation, and what all of these rules actually mean and why maybe we have some of them in place and what they are supposed to do. In order to have this discussion, I thought I would reach out to an esteemed guest, and we are very fortunate to have with us today Tamara Krachenko. She's an assistant professor at UVic's School of Public Admin. Hello, Tamara.
Hi, Dean. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the esteemed connotations. Fine.
Well, you know, it's a real pleasure. I'm delighted to have you as a guest on the podcast today. So why don't you tell folks a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm pretty new to Victoria, and I just find it astonishingly beautiful. I moved here 2 years ago to Paris, where I was working for a big international organization, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And I was an analyst working on a lot of urban development issues, and I led research on the governance of land use in various countries. And I'm really passionate about this work because it's an area where you see policies play out in a visible way across our land, and all of these choices create these incentives and disincentives for different behavior. And a lot of those policies are kind of explicit policies that exist in the land planning system, so in zoning laws and so on. But some of them are policies from other levels of government, even like fiscal policies, for instance, from upper level governments that also shape our land use. And so that was this encompassing view that my work brought. And it was really fascinating to learn about leading practices in different countries, including the Netherlands and France and so on.
And so you mentioned this funny little spot we have on the southern tip of Vancouver Island, and which is now your home for the last couple of years. And it seems to have, I guess, as expected on any island, it's got its quirks. And that includes some strong reaction to change at times. And that's really what got me thinking about recording this episode and reaching out to you. One of those things that seems to have emerged recently has been this move by the province to create a couple of affordable housing locations, developments. One's going into Saanich and one's going into central Saanich. And I noticed with interest, not surprisingly, there's been quite a bit of pushback, particularly on the central Saanich side, people organizing demonstrations concerned about, well, quite frankly, I think they're concerned about the kinds of people who might be moving into their neighborhood. And not to delegitimize some of the concerns they may have, but it struck me that our whole process is geared around making decisions about who gets to move into neighborhoods, and our zoning rules and regulations around land use really can have an effect of being exclusionary by design. And so I'm not suggesting that's what's going on in central Saanich, but this has been historically a practice that we've seen forming the canon of land use. And so I thought I'd ask you, what is exclusionary zoning, and how does it relate to this form of discrimination?
So we know that access to housing is unequal, and we have laws against discrimination. But then we keep seeing members of disadvantaged groups have a harder time finding a quality place. And we know this is true, and there have been lots of studies. For instance, there are studies that do paired testing, so that you have two people that are assigned different identities and they apply for the same place, and then you can demonstrate, well, why did one person get in and the other didn't? So we can demonstrate discrimination in the housing market in a lot of different ways. I lived in Halifax for years. I saw this myself. I was really shocked to discover that my neighbor, whose bathtub had fallen through his ceiling, was in fact paying more in rent than me. And he happened to be African American. So these are very overt forms of discrimination where individuals aren't able to access quality housing, and we can demonstrate that in different ways. And so while that speaks to individual forms of discrimination by property owners, for instance, there's this broader issue of class-based discrimination that is less direct, perhaps less obvious, but it has the same problematic outcomes. And that's what we mean when we say exclusionary zoning. It's the use of zoning ordinances to exclude certain types of land uses from a given community. And there's, in fact, a huge literature on this, especially in the United States, where exclusionary zoning has been prevalent for over a century. And these practices are no less prevalent in Canada. I think that we haven't been talking about them as much, but I see that they're in the news more and more. And so the fight against exclusionary zoning, particularly in the 60s and 70s in the States, it was really at the forefront of the civil rights movement. And these types of practices, they were often adopted under the auspices of just making sure that a neighborhood keeps its look and feel. That sounds benign, right? We're protecting incumbent property owners' interests and investments. The thing about exclusionary zoning is that these practices can differ. It doesn't look the same from place to place. And it's not the only impediment, you can say, to meeting housing needs. So even if you removed exclusionary zoning and you were to deal with that, it doesn't mean that you would necessarily fix some of the housing affordability problems. Its removal is important, but it's not the only condition to provide adequate housing. But to give you some examples of exclusionary zoning, because there are so many, but a couple historical ones are that California cities in the 1880s, they restricted laundries to specific districts, and laundries were generally owned and operated by Chinese Americans. And so it made it really clear that they couldn't live in certain areas. New York City had renowned policies on height and bulk restrictions, and these were used to shut out immigrant-packed tenements out of single-family districts. And Toronto even had really interesting kind of morality exclusionary zoning rules to prevent women from moving to the city to work in factories from living on their own. So we have so many examples, and they continue to this day.
It's fascinating, you know, for someone who used to be on a municipal council, it is so interesting to learn that, you know, I think about the term character, which often gets built into discussions around land use. And I'd always thought of it in terms of like form and character, looking at the type, the archetype of these houses that went into neighborhoods. But what I've come to understand is that the term character is actually a euphemism for the people. It is meant to, or at least traditionally, has been used as a way to talk about the ideal individuals and families who are going to settle into a particular neighborhood. And so when you talk about protecting the character of a neighborhood, well, I think maybe many of us use that kind of terminology without appreciating what it actually represents. There's a whole history of that kind of terminology being used as a way to deliberately discriminate against those folks who would potentially be moving into the area who aren't like us. They're not the most desirable residents in this neighborhood.
Yeah, and I think it's useful to point out, like, what does that actually look like? So what can that be? That can be minimum lot sizes. It can be requirements that you have parking. It can be height restrictions, all of which serve to increase costs, right? And so these are ways of keeping a neighborhood in character, you know, if you want single family homes, but it also keeps lower income individuals out of certain neighborhoods altogether. And in Greater Victoria, you have, you know, low density housing in these amenity rich, well-serviced neighborhoods. And meanwhile, I'm kind of astonished when I bike out to Langford and I see that the side of a mountain has been deforested to accommodate the growing demand for housing and all of the costs associated with that, all of those infrastructure costs. Meanwhile, we have inefficient land use in serviced areas. So maintaining the shape of these sorts of established older neighborhoods while the city has grown around it, it's so common in cities across North America, but it's also, I'd like to highlight, illogical, because lower income individuals are pushed areas that are further away where they have a harder time accessing services. They need to pay more for transportation and it costs. It's costly also to the city. And just as one example, in 2016, the city of Edmonton calculated that the net capital and infrastructure costs less the new tax income generated by three new suburban neighborhoods would cost the city $1.4 billion. So if you don't care for other reasons, we should care for fiscal reasons that this is an illogical use of land. It's inefficient.
And so, I mean, that's one of the consequences of this kind of deliberate design to keep to these particular kinds of housing developments, where these are single family homes, which, as you've said, are very inefficient in terms of access and the delivery of infrastructure to those locations, but also have the effect of driving out of those centers those folks who are looking to be new settlers in the community that may be trying to access the same kind of quality of life that's advertised as so desirable in these single family subdivisions. So then it creates this further sprawl. It exacerbates the environmental challenges that we've got. You talked about Langford blowing up mountainsides and ripping out trees in order to create more homes for more people. And then the cost of that is just added on to the people, to the residents who are seeking those homes. So, I mean, you can see how the challenges just compound and how we keep kind of running into more and more affordability issues and to say nothing of the environmental costs and the consequence to those residents who want to live there. But I think what's so significant is that it also represents a loss to those neighbors, to the people who would maybe be lobbying against having more housing types, more zonings that were inclusive of different kinds of designs that allowed for multifamily living, that could maybe help to diversify some of the neighborhood with different opportunities for new buyers to move into that community. It's really their loss because they're standing up against what they view as, I guess, degrading the character of the neighborhood.
Yeah, it depends on the framing you take. And so we tend to think in municipal way, in neighborhood way here in Victoria. Your institutions of governance are set up that way. You don't think regionally necessarily because we have separate municipalities, right? So an amalgamated city, you might think a little bit different. You might think maybe more regionally, at least you would make decisions more regionally about the incentives and disincentives among these different approaches. I'm also hearing a lot from people, though, that they're concerned for intergenerational reasons. They want their children to be able to live near them. And they are incredibly concerned about the potential of younger generations to afford in their city. So I think we're seeing, it's just the problem has gotten so bad. I think we're starting to see the need for solutions, creative solutions and more flexibility. Because land use planning is incredibly rigid and slow in achieving its goals. There are a lot of examples of other places that are doing this differently. And I think one of the things that could ally some of the, you know, allay some of the concerns individuals have, and I think that there is a very valid concern that when there is growing density in the neighborhood, that the proper investments aren't going to keep up, right? That you're not going to have proper investments in services and in schools and in the right transportation investments and in other public amenities, environmental amenities, that it's not going to keep up with a lot of development. And I think that that's such a valid argument, and that we could do much better. The city could do much better in negotiating a better deal from developers and contributions to these critical amenities that maintain quality of life when there's increasing density. And also just plan better for it. So, you know, if you're going to have status quo and new people and, you know, new developments in your neighborhood and a lot more stress on the neighborhood, a lot more congestion, for sure, you have very good reason to be concerned. There are ways to manage that in a better, more flexible and responsive way.
So what are some of the ways to create rules around land use that don't continue to drive up these kinds of challenges, particularly as it comes to cost, but we make these efforts to try and preserve the character of neighborhoods according to what we view as ideal. But we know that there are examples out there of communities that are trying things differently, that they want to see us be more inclusive in our approach and ensure that equity is at the center of some of those decision making around land use. What does that look like?
Yeah, so the flip side of exclusionary zoning is inclusionary zoning, and that's basically refers to zoning regulation or land use ordinances that require developers of projects of a certain size to produce a set amount of affordable housing in their market rate residential developments in order to get development approval. And this can be mandatory or voluntary. And this isn't a new thing. So since Vancouver's been doing this since the 80s, for instance. And in many ways, inclusionary housing might be a better term, but it's kind of this administrative program. So that's one set of practices. And Vancouver has required this since 1988, 20% of the units in new neighborhoods be designated for non-market housing. And then Montreal had a voluntary incentive-based program. And there have been other places across Canada too. And people who have analyzed these programs, the results are kind of mixed. So, sort of underwhelming. So those incentive programs are nice, but is that enough? And I think that actually Lisa Helps made a few recommendations recently in her Community Making Requires Housing of All Sorts article. And they were really quite good, I think. So the first one is, amend the city's official community plan and rezone the whole city so that currently zoned single family lots can have up to 4 units as a right. Now, mean things suddenly have that? Well, no, people are going to have choice though. And up to 4 units is not that big. That's sort of a gentle density. So that's a really effective way actually to be more inclusive in your zoning practices. And the other one was to get rid of parking minimums. If Edmonton can do this, we can do this here. More and more people, families like mine, a family of 4, don't own a car. I don't need a parking spot. And there isn't market choice for that. And it's an inefficient use of land if you mandate that. So those are ways to bring costs down. I think that those were really smart recommendations that she made and ones that could really quickly, change things. And the other thing is just to communicate better with neighborhoods and to be much more proactive when we negotiate with developers. Now, this would have to be changed in law, right? But to negotiate more, to negotiate on environmental amenities, to negotiate on those key things that make quality of life so great in neighborhoods when a big development is coming in, because then the community really sees that it benefits and that the density isn't just coming at us at a cost.
So certainly, I think that what happens then is the trade-off discussion you have with communities, right? Or with neighborhoods and the neighbors that live there, that we're asking all parts of our community to accept a density of some variety. And that's going to, we'll vary according to wherever we are. And obviously, from a land use perspective, we want to try and get density on those major corridors or close to, so people can get on the bus or use the active transportation infrastructure that we're very slowly starting to build in Greater Victoria. I live in Saanich, so we've got a long way to go, but we're getting there. There's going to be a variety of kinds of density that's going to go into neighborhoods. But the trade-off that we're seeking is that as part of accepting this and the change that it's going to bring to the neighborhood, in addition to allowing for young families to move into areas that might be otherwise unaffordable as single family homes, we're also going to be seeking a greater contribution towards the amenities that make these neighborhoods desirable in the first place. And so how do we approach that? You were saying there's some legal changes required in order to make that happen. How do municipalities begin that process?
Well, what can you negotiate from with developers right now, right?
Yes.
There's only a certain number of things you can do, and you could broaden it. And you could say for really large developments, what needs to be on the table is this, that, and the other. Another thing is cities can be more activist than they are. They can take land that they own. They can increase the value of that land by putting amenities there, building out roads, building parks, and so on. They structure the space. the value of the land then increases. For instance, if they deliver, you know, suddenly there's a transportation available to that piece of land that wasn't available before. Because they've added that value, they then sell the land to the developer for the final development, and they structure that process. So they tell them what they need based on what they see as the, you know, what are the key issues for them. So often in Amsterdam, that's an equity lens. They really want to see what they call mixity in their city. It's a major priority. And they make money off of it. And then they do other good things. So, you know, that's much more of an activist view, interventionist view in the housing market. And it can, I'm not quite sure how municipalities would leverage money for that here, but I think it can be done, and it's more creative, right?
That's fascinating to hear, because I think that there are so many opportunities where, particularly in our region, you see holdings that local governments have where they could be using those opportunities to create the kinds of housing and land use that they want to achieve and then put it out to market. You know, it's already near shopping. It's on an active transportation route or near buses. You've got great restaurants around the corner. Now we're going to take this area and we're going to put it out there and say, we want to create a diversity of housing types here. And we're going to use the revenue from that in order to pay for some greater amenities that will benefit the surrounding residents, including the new folks who are going to be moving into that new type of housing.
Mm-hmm. TransLink does this a little bit with their, how they have used their transportation investments to leverage the increase of value in the land around those investments and then pour that back into the funding mechanism. So the American cities do this a lot, that type of transportation financing based on growth in land values. But Canadian cities have been pretty new at it. That's sort of a different than what Amsterdam does. It's not always related to transit, but it can be done. We can ask for more. It's possible.
So equity is a major, I think, not well understood element that local governments actually have a lot of control over. And I'm curious, I know this is an area that you're interested in as well. Can you talk a little bit about what that means in terms of the mechanisms available to local governments in order to achieve a greater degree of equity within our communities?
Well, they clearly have zoning. Yes. But that's challenging, right? Because you need political buy-in. And so I think that what we found from the studies of inclusionary zoning practices in Canada to date have said that these requirements for developers, for instance, to include a certain amount of below market housing have delivered housing, but probably not fast enough. And so I think a key point here is, even with inclusionary zoning practices, there are a whole bunch of other things that have to happen. Housing is complex, it's multidimensional. It makes developing effective housing policy challenging. It's been embedded in these other larger institutions like capital markets. People think of it as a commodity, as an asset, as a, you know, a sector of the economy, a physical structure. Indigenous peoples have deep connections to land. There's a whole different, you know, view on what on land and its meaning as a, so other levels of government. I think this is a key point of the work I've done on the governance of land use, is that we all need to be pulling in the same direction, and that there are a whole bunch of policies across levels of government that impact how land is used, often not very intentionally. And we need to align them, and we need to be much more conscious about how these other policies play out across the land. And clearly Canada needs a lot more attention to housing policy, and including federally. And I think that it's become such a critical issue. It's become an intergenerational justice issue that we're going to see a lot more creative solutions in the coming years.
Where would you start? What are some of the things that would be that's lacking in terms of coordination or and alignment between levels of government in order to address it?
Oh, in order to give you a very informed answer, I'd need to do a comprehensive land use study, which I have yet to do in Canada or in Victoria. But
well, just in broad terms, what would you want to see?
Well, inclusionary zoning would be a big one. I'd love to see federal programs that promoted cooperative housing, much like they had in the 80s. I actually grew up in co-op housing in Edmonton, and a lot of those programs were reduced and they were critical. So we've had, you know, the co-op housing sector has declined as a result. And whenever I've attended a few presentations from people who try and deliver below market housing, and it is so challenging, and the reasons are pretty complicated, but it has a lot to do with how these are financed. And so a lot, I think, has to happen with housing finance that, I mean, I wouldn't be able to get into the specifics. Many other people could speak much more effectively to that issue, but you know, these are creative people working with the support of municipalities, often with the support of the province, and they're still not able to deliver these projects. Getting rid of parking minimum requirements.
Are there things that you really want people to understand about this issue that they may be, on the face of it, it isn't entirely clear where these challenges come from or what's frustrating the problem, but from your perspective, what do people need to understand?
I think that when we look at land use and we look at how things are now, we have to realize that that is all part of a choice and a system of incentives that are playing out and shaping how land is used and managed, and that system of incentives can be changed, and there are ways to do that well, and we have kind of a rigid system, I think, in Canada. I've studied systems in other countries that are a little bit more flexible and creative. And I think that coming with the pandemic, we saw that we can be flexible and creative in our land use. We can reallocate space. We can bring businesses into spaces where they haven't been before. And that our streets can come alive, actually, and children can feel safer. And we can do all these things. And I would welcome a bit more flexibility and creativity. And some of the systems I've studied, again, going back to the Netherlands, they hate it when you tell them that they are good at stuff like land use plan, which is probably why they are so good at it. But they do a lot of management on the basis of environmental values or on the basis of nuisance planning, for instance, nuisance zoning. So you can actually put a lot of functions together. And the role of the land use planner then changes incredibly. You are no longer working to develop, a land use plan. You're working with individuals on the ground to ensure that different functions can coexist over time and managing conflict. And the training for that is social training. So even the way that their disciplinary framing is different than in other countries. They tend to be sometimes, you know, social anthropologists and so on. So there are other more flexible and iterative ways of managing land that can lead to better equity outcomes.
Oh, you mentioned, you know, we're kind of reaching a point of crisis where we need to begin thinking differently and acting differently collectively to address an inaccessible housing market for many folks. And then you also talked about something, a phenomenon that I have noticed and talked about on this podcast, which is that the pandemic has kind of inspired these much more nimble, flexible responses on the part of local governments to try things out and to be responsive to what are obviously fairly serious concerns in order to create a more comfortable, desirable place for people under extraordinary circumstances. And I wondered if maybe there's a confluence here where these things are coming together in a way that might usher in a new era of doing things or trying things differently. If local governments have maybe become a little more comfortable with just relaxing some of the regulations or trying out different policies and processes, coupled with the urgency to address a very serious situation in terms of housing affordability. Do you think that we maybe are entering into a period of doing things differently and addressing some of these challenges?
Maybe. I think that everyone's been quite horrified by the fact that we have thousands of people living in tents in parks, which is unacceptable. So I don't hope that that is a solution. I hope people can have secure housing. But I do think that flexible use of space is key. And I'd love to see more flexibility for businesses to use space and dynamic use of space and pop-up shows and just more dynamic neighborhoods. And I hope that we can learn from that process that it's possible and that people will enjoy it and make streets kind of safer for pedestrians and for children and so on.
Tamara Krashenko is an assistant professor at UVic's School of Public Admin. Tamara, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. I feel like I've learned so much in such a short amount of time, and this has been a real benefit to have your input and sharing some of your knowledge with us. I'm sure that the folks out there listening are equally impressed by what's been shared here. And I feel inspired too, like you've given us a real sense of opportunity, which is always a great way to leave things, especially when you're dealing with such intense and difficult subject matter.
Thanks for having me, Dean. You're most kind.
This has been another episode of Amazing Places. I'm Dean Murdoch. Thanks for listening.